Hi, you're listening to What's the Schemata, a schema therapy podcast for therapists. With ISST accredited schema therapy supervisors and trainers, Chris Hayes and Rob Brockman. For more information on schema therapy, visit our website, schematherapytraining.com.
Hi, everybody, and welcome to
What's the Schemata? Schemata?
We try to do it in time every time, but I think we did it right.
It never works.
Fantastic. Yeah, so today we are very, very lucky to have a really old friend of ours. We've known Susan, I think known her for about 15 years, but it's so nice to see her. It's Susan Simpson. So Susan Simpson is a clinical psychologist based in Scotland. She's from Australia. Doesn't sound like a Scottish accent, does it?
Nah.
But before we go into the interview, Rob, we have got a little project that is about to be released to the masses called the Schema Therapy Solution. Do you want to do your little spiel?
Correct. Yeah, we've been busy little rabbits, you know, running around behind the scenes, you know, working on a project. We call it the Schema Therapy Solution. You can check it out actually now at schematherapysolution.com. And well, the idea, it's a reinventing your life style course for everyday living, for everyday folks. I think we all know somebody who might benefit from some schema awareness, some awareness of their coping styles, you know, getting to know their own gear in a way. I know I personally benefited a lot from learning the model. And I think, you know, we've observed that therapists learning the model, a part of the enthusiasm is that it's exciting to understand your own stuff, you know, and to get that awareness. And it can be infectious in a way. Yeah. You can get the schema bug. And we designed this course thinking then, you know, why shouldn't other people get access to this kind of stuff, you know, and to better to develop themselves and gain some self-awareness. So the Schema Therapy Solution, and it's a collaboration, right, between myself, Rob Brockman, Chris
that's you.
Hayes, that's me, yeah, Chris Hayes, that's you.
Me.
And Wendy Bahari from the United States. So, yeah, we're super excited.
So the first alliteration, the first start of this course is going to be on April 30. But without further ado, I think we need to introduce Susan
Doctor
Simpson.
Susan. Dr. Simpson.
Susan Simpson. Cool. Yeah, that's a...
So Susan, nice to have you back again.
Yeah, it's Susan.
Yay. The pod.
Lovely to see you both.
We've been watching from a distance, and I've got to admit, wanted to get you on the pod as of late last year. You published an awesome paper alongside your colleague Lamour Nevot on pseudo vulnerability in psychotherapy. I tell everyone that I run into who's a schema therapist, this is the paper I wish I wrote last year. it was absolutely sort of nailed it for me on an issue that comes up a lot, I think, for schema therapists and for therapists. So,
absolutely. Yeah. It's one of these things where you kind of go read it and go, oh, even that term, it's like, yes, this is just, you know, hit a little black hole.
Of course. Where have you been all my life? No.
Exactly.
So the paper, it's in the Frontiers in Frontiers in Psychiatry. We'll have the link up on the pod side. It's called Differentiating Authentic versus Pseudo Vulnerability in Therapeutic Practice. So we wanted to get you on and talk about the paper. And so why don't we just start with, we'll get straight into it. Like, how did you come into this? Like, how did you come up with the idea to write a paper on pseudo vulnerability? This is such an important topic for a lot of schema therapists.
Yeah, I think for me, it began about 10 years ago when I was working with a client. In fact, you probably remember, Chris, because I remember actually talking with you about this at the time, a client that I just couldn't figure out what was going on. I was reparenting like mad. She had, I guess, quite significant borderline PD features. And there was an abandonment schema, dependent schema, but the reparenting was just going nowhere, wasn't being internalized. So she was coming back for more. She was really, seemed to be getting a lot out of therapy, seemed to be working hard, attending very regularly, but just there wasn't that shift in terms of internalization of the reparenting. There wasn't the development of her own healthy adult self.
Something's missing. Something's not happening.
Let's Something's go. Missing here. Mm. Quite a resistance actually to developing her own healthy adult side. The therapy was, and the reparenting in a sense, she was doing the imagery rescripting and the experiential techniques, but it was more as if she was using that, that the reparenting was a fix or an addictive. I was the addiction in a sense. And
like a self-soother or something. Like she needed,
you've had a bad feeling,
she has to come and see Susan this week and then, relieve that feeling.
Susan. Right, but she didn't internalize any of that, and there wasn't a healthy adult that was kind of growing, and I couldn't figure out what was happening, and it's got a lot of different supervision on it and on working with this person, and no one else seemed to know either, and it just slowly dawned on me, really, hang on, this is a coping mode here, and I guess there was a quite strong countertransference as well. You know, I found that I was losing my empathy. At the beginning, I had a lot of empathy. I was feeling that I was losing that. I was starting to feel burnt out. I was starting to feel quite resentful. But I was trying to override that, ignoring my own, instinct on that, and became really complicit with the fear and the avoidance that often goes along with the abandonment schema.
Oh, when I was reading it, I thought to myself, I don't know about how you feel, Rob, but I thought this sounds like someone who's had, I'm sure Susan has had experience personally with someone who was incredibly difficult.
Oh, for sure.
And you're getting sucked into it. It was almost like autobiographical element to it.
This is the thing with I think psychotherapists in general, and especially those if they write, if you're writing case studies or if you're involved in writing chapters or something. Often if you ask them about, how you got it goes back to like a tricky case or a series of tricky cases where, and it's like, this thing that they couldn't figure out, and then they become the guy or the one who's studying OCD or, that kind of thing.
Mm. Yeah, absolutely. And I noticed that a lot of my supervisees were coming to me with similar cases, and it slowly dawned on me, hang on a minute, I think there are a lot of people on a lot of people's caseloads that have this mode or one of these pseudo-vulnerable modes and are doing the same thing, reparenting, and therapy goes on for a long, long time. There's no end in sight. In fact, the therapist often becomes really afraid of talking about endings, kind of tiptoe around the endings because they're so afraid of triggering that abandonment schema.
So let's just backtrack a bit then. So let's get a bit of, can you give us a bit of a definition on pseudo vulnerability and what sort of signs are is a therapist looking for within the relationship with a client? What are the flags?
I mean, of course, as we've listed in the paper, there are a range of different, pseudo vulnerable modes, and the feel of them and the countertransference is quite different, but I guess there is a kind of a mimicking of vulnerability with these modes. So there is a sense in which the mode is playing the role of a vulnerable child mode or talking about vulnerability, but not really connecting to the vulnerability. Or if they are vulnerable, it's more this kind of global distress, this kind of vague global distress, rather than it being like a vulnerable child where you really feel that this is, kind of the specific feelings that are linked to specific schemas.
Like buffered almost. Sounds like a buffered kind of feeling. It's
Yeah, not, yeah. Mm. And often people will say things like, I'm depressed or I'm suicidal or things are awful or things are bad. So there's often this kind of global language.
Mm. Or nothing's helplessness is one of them. Nothing can help me. I might as well give up. You can't help. No, I'm hopeless.
Yeah, exactly. So there's that, global language, but they're not really talking about a feeling. So it's, that I'm suicidal. Suicidal isn't a feeling. It's a kind of a coping urge, really. Yeah. The feeling is the vulnerable child feeling underneath is this kind of, distress, despair, overwhelm, anxiety, which they're kind of one step removed from. They're talking. And often there is an element of trying to show us how distressed they are through the language, but without really authentically connecting to the emotion. Yeah.
Not having to experience it directly, which I imagine would be more distressing.
Yeah. Absolutely. Absolutely.
It sounds possibly alienating, but it doesn't really seem enduring to the therapist. It's not like it's making you feel closer and more connected, and it's kind of off-putting or doesn't
really. Well, to start with, It's a bit, I think for most clients, especially with the helpless surrender, it's the opposite, where I think start with, we feel like we want to rescue. We feel like we want to help this person. So we often feel, I guess, strong feelings of wanting to help to start with. And often there's this confusion about why are other people not responding? Why are other people rolling their eyes when this patient's coming? I feel like this patient really needs my help. So often the first step in the counter transference is wanting to help, wanting to even rescue. And then in the second stage of counter transference is where we start to burn out a bit. We start to lose our empathy. We start to feel like, hang on a minute, you know, we're feeling helpless now. We're the ones that are feeling stuck. We're feeling all those kind of maybe underlying emotions that the client maybe feels underneath, but they're not really connecting with.
I thought you were going to say lose your hair. Pulling your hair out.
Yeah. Well, exactly.
Yeah.
And it is like that.
Hair pulling mode.
Yeah.
And then there's some parallels to this kind of drama triangle sort of thing too, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the drama triangle can be a really great way of working with these modes, because it can really help to unpack the dynamics in the family of origin that led to the development and led to that person kind of getting stuck in there. Because this is a universal concept, isn't it? That we all, you know, have some experience of operating on the drama triangle in our own families, where one person is the rescuer, one is the perpetrator, and one person is the victim. And I think in a lot of, certainly in many of my clients with eating disorders, that there is this dynamic where the mother and daughter, for example, get stuck on the rescuer victim kind of dynamic. And often dad's cast out in perpetrator. And the daughter kind of feels trapped on that triangle in one of those roles, you know, and that they maybe switch between rescuer and victim. But if there's to come off that dynamic, then they're cast as the perpetrator. So they're scared to come off because then they become the bad guy on the triangle.
Totally.
So just to clarify, so if listeners haven't heard this, it's the Karpman drama triangle. We might put up some lists, some sort of information about it so you can get some ideas. But it's extremely helpful.
In that triangle, the client, whichever pseudo vulnerable mode they're in, we're saying they would be playing that victim role, right? The role of the victim initially, and be casting you as the rescuer, and you may even be feeling like that as well, or feeling the pull to rescue the client, or certainly to help them. And I guess this will come later when we talk about how do we deal with this, because it does mean challenging that role of only being in this compassionate rescuer role and doing other things such as empathic confrontation. But the fear for us can be that we'll end up being cast as a persecutor.
Right, exactly. Yeah.
You don't want to get it wrong, do you? When someone's really being vulnerable and you're sort of empathically confronting them.
One of the fascinating things...
We're taught in schema therapy to nurture when we have the vulnerable child when we have that vulnerability to do the nurturing, that the empathic confrontation is usually around, I guess, when someone's overcompensating or extreme avoidance, but often, you know, we don't necessarily recognize this as avoidance.
And when in a state of distress that looks very closely like vulnerability.
Exactly.
It's hard to pick up. It's hard to, right?
Yeah.
Is it right to say, and here I'm talking for myself here, but I wonder what you think. I always try to trust my gut on this one. It's almost always the first sign for me is my own feelings, like, you know, leaning in doesn't feel right, or you start to feel strange about the vulnerability that's being displayed. Can you say something about that?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think part of the problem, if we have our own schemas that are operating as self-sacrifice, subjugation, so forth, we're more likely to override our own gut feeling about this stuff, to tell ourselves that we should be, you know, more empathic, more nurturing, for example. And therefore we override that kind of sense that, something's not right here, or I'm starting to feel a bit irritated. And we tend to, you know, I guess, especially as schema therapists, tell ourselves, come on, we've got to be in this for the duration. We've got to show this client that they really matter and that they're important to us. And in doing so, override our own stuff. And I think the countertransference is so informative. It's so important to tune into that, because that it really is, I think you're absolutely right, our strongest compass in terms of what's going on here. Is this an authentic mode, or is this a coping mode? And if so, how is it trying to get this person's needs met? What are the needs underneath that are kind of being hidden and that are driving this? What are the fears as well about showing authentic vulnerability?
Mm-hmm. It's so interesting, because if you look, what you guys have done is brilliant, because you've picked up, like in the literature and talking to other schema therapists, right? You had, I think Dave Bernstein had published, what was it called? The schema mode.
Observation scale.
Yes. And he had the complaining protector was in there. And then Dave Edwards had, was it the victim mode?
Victim self-pity
mode. Yeah. And you know, there's been different writers have picked up on that there's something there, right? There's the Dutch guys, I think might have been the Dutch, had this sort of the attention seeker mode, right? And so what you guys have done is draw all that together and say, these are actually... Well, there's a group of modes, isn't there? There's a group of modes. Yeah. We could call them, I think it's a great term, by the way, pseudo vulnerability modes. And we need to be on the lookout for them, you know? So in summary, I think that's a fantastic job you guys have done for the community, drawing that together and drawing attention to it, that this is a big stumbling block for therapy.
Absolutely. And Dave Edwards' recent paper, because that our paper in Frontiers was part of a series of papers that was, I guess, coordinated on schema therapy topics. And the first article in that was written by Dave Edwards. And he kind of, I guess, teases out in more detail, I guess, the kind of specifics of what those, so he gives them a range of other names that are kind of maybe more specific to the behaviours that go with each of them as well. So that's another interesting paper. Yeah.
What's interesting too is that I think we've found them hard to conceptualise as surrender, overcompensation, avoidance. Like, you know, I think it actually makes a lot of sense just to group them together in a certain way, but it's hard to pin them down. But what I really like is the idea, you know, when I started learning schema therapy, and even now with supervisees, they'll bring you clients that are, of course, they bring you the clients that aren't progressing, right, in supervision. And initially they might bring you ones that are either like detached protector or full-on avoidance, right, and they can't get them in the therapy, right, emotionally. Right, so avoidance style detached clients, or you'll get people who have trouble with overcompensators, clients who come in and they're dominating the sessions, or they're over controlling, or they're attacking, or whatever. Right, this is another group of clients that trouble therapists, and this is the other group, right? This is the other group that they come in for supervision, and it's like, oh, there's this group of clients that are, you know, troubling me, and it's inducing all this transference and counter transference. So I think it's really cool. Yeah, it's really helped me too in my practice.
Oh, I'm really glad to hear that. I mean, I think it is difficult because they do, you know, they do, many of our clients cycle between these different modes, and they'll have, you know, backup modes and backup modes. So you'll have that confrontation with the first pseudo-vulnerable mode, there'll be another pseudo-vulnerable mode waiting behind, you know, so you've got to kind of be, it's mode chess. You've got to kind of be quite strategic and stick to your guns, really, knowing that you know, I guess they're just trying to protect themselves. But I think as well, when I went to, I guess, find a name for helpless surrenderer, I really was swinging backwards and forwards between different names, because I think there is an overcompensation element, you know, and there is an avoidant element, and there is a surrender element. And it's really difficult sometimes to place them. Sometimes I think helpless surrenderer is the most controlling mode of all. It's an over-controller wolf in sheep's clothing, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
So there's about six or seven different modes, and we've touched on a couple already, and we'll, you know, steer you into, you know, having a bit of a bigger kind of read on that from the article. But is there any kind of origins that it kind of overarch this sort of presentation? Are there themes that are apparent that, you know, kind of would bring the client to need to resort to these sorts of modes and coping?
So you're talking about kind of origins in childhood?
Yeah. When growing up, you know, is there some sort of, sort of theme that you see in terms of the origins?
We always blame the childhood, so.
How did you learn to be this way?
I mean, you know, usually it is because authentic vulnerability was overlooked, was dismissed, was sidelined, you know, that many of our clients were kind of parentified and their own need was seen as less legitimate than those of other family members. You know, so, you know, if a parent had a mental health illness or a physical illness, then the child's own need was seen as not legitimate. Their emotional needs for support, for care were seen as less legitimate. Or if they had a sibling, for example, who had significant needs, then their own needs become less significant. But I think, you know, there's this real theme of emotional deprivation. Lack of attunement is really significant here, because often the child just hasn't learned to differentiate their inner experience. They haven't experienced emotional containment. So inside, they often feel that they feel out of control. They feel like overwhelmed by their inner experience, and there's been a lack of containment of that. Often the care that is offered is kind of quite practical care, you know, so it's more sometimes overprotection, overprotective care. So to all intents and purposes, with a lot of these clients, it looks like they've had a good childhood, but the care's been very practical. Sure.
Yeah,
right. And so when they come to us, they're seeking that practical care, because that's all they know. They don't often know what love is, what connection is.
And what induces the practical care is a sort of vulnerable narrative.
Sorry, can you say that again, Rob?
And what induces practical care is a sort of vulnerable narrative.
Yes, exactly.
You know, they don't have to actually, display or be vulnerable or be the child.
No.
It's enough to tell a vulnerable narrative about something bad's happened or.
Yeah. And often within that family of origin, of course, that's how they've learned to get needs met. They've learned what is considered legitimate in terms of having a need in this family, and how can I legitimize my needs to fit with this narrative. So if if you've got a really, a family where there's lot diagnoses, having diagnoses and being risky is the way that you compete for your needs to be legitimate, then that's the way you'll go about it. Or if physical illness, but it's not
not a conscious process. And that's the other thing. Can I just clarify, Susan, and I'm not sure what you're going to say here, that I don't think your paper really, really infers that this is an explicit process, like that people, make it up or something like that. You know what I mean? Like, I think this is outside of awareness to a degree, that this is how it plays out. It's not that people wake up and think, oh, I want to do this or something.
Exactly. And there's a lot of shame around it. And this is where, often the person has experienced a lot of shame around their authentic vulnerability, their authentic needs. So it's painful to express that authentic self. And so this has developed, as you say, as a kind of an unconscious way of coping, probably very early on in childhood for many of our clients. It's interesting, though, when you do bring it up, some clients will immediately kind of, they can see that, and will acknowledge that this is the case for them, that they will acknowledge that they have this side. Other people, it can take a while, or that they'll talk about it one session and then don't want to go back there again, because it is painful and it can feel shameful. But I had a client come to me recently who had obviously been online and maybe reading some of this.
Really?
And, I think I've got to help the Surendra this time.
Yeah.
So I thought, that's great.
Getting it out there.
Makes things easier when they can own it. Because I guess the thing is that, it's a balance between the therapist, who generally is, thoughtful, considered and nurturing, and having to kind of call things out. Even the concept of, sort of pseudo-vulnerability, it does sound like someone's being a little bit manipulative or, some sort of deliberate action with this. Was there anything that you could suggest for, the listeners and therapists that are learning the model, how do they can be connected and still be empathic and engaged when you know that this is happening, or you kind of start to formulate it?
I mean, I think there are ways of you know, certainly for us as therapists, just keeping that image of the client as a little child, getting them, as we would with an overcompensator mode, getting them to bring in a photo, for example, of themselves as a little child, really knowing the history, knowing and really, I guess, having confidence ourselves in knowing that there is a little child underneath that is not getting his or her needs met, that is waiting to be seen. And that, you know, I think it comes back to, you know, that concept of, you know, I get that there's this side of you that wants to tell me about how difficult things are, but I also get that there's this little part of you that wants, that needs to connect, that needs to, and I think as well, it's that stuff that Wendy Bihari uses, of course, with the empathic confrontation. Look, it's me, you know, I'm here, I'm already here. You don't need to show me how bad things are. I already get it. I'm not your mum. You know, that when you were little, you had no way, no one believed you, no one saw you, no one really got it. But I get it. I see what's happening for you, you know, so that this side is working so hard to make sure that people understand you and get you and understand how difficult it is for you. But I'm already here. So I think it's partly showing the client that we are on their side and that we really understand it. And
that's what's striking me a bit, is the really understanding it bit, because I do get a sense that it's a lot, these sorts of modes can be a lot to do with acts of omission and deprivation, these sorts of things. And
right.
I think I get a sense from you is really getting what's going on and how people responded to emotions and needs, rather, which is often over, you know, it's picked up when it's defective as or other schemas because things are happening. But that kind of lack of stuff, it's so nuanced and so subtle. It's the soundtrack going in the background and you don't necessarily notice it.
And of course, invariably, people's networks are exhausted. You know, that's one of the signs, right? Like, so you speak to them and then you say, how, you know, what's going on socially? What's going on with your partner? I mean, it's usually a wreck, right?
The support networks, you mean, like the
support networks are exhausted. Yeah. Right? I mean, they've tended to really struggle to maintain support networks.
Exactly. Because everyone else has burnt out around them as well.
Yeah.
Everyone else has become, you know, the client that I was talking about that I was working with 10 years ago, We called this mode her helpless surrender, the mummy fantasy mode, that everyone was potentially the mummy that she never had as a little child. And she was just basically like, she was going to each person, will you be my mummy? Will you be my mummy? And I think people would say yes to start with, gosh, yes, you know, of course I'll help you. And then would just burn out and then she'd be on to the next one.
Yeah. And from the outside, you can see it. Like if you're in the network, you say, oh, like maybe this person, so they've roped in this other lady, they've roped in some lady from church and you're like, oh, like now it's going to go, it's going to go on again. Or like you can see the cycle, the networks, and of course you become a part of that. So the paper suggests, I think, correctly that as a therapist, we want to be leaning into our empathic confrontation and maybe more the limit setting techniques, part of our limited reparenting, as a core technique to manage the pseudo vulnerability. And while I definitely agree with that, I guess the elephant in the room is that, you know, the fear is that the client who would either be defensive or feel like you're not listening, or actually feel maltreated or victimized further by the therapist.
Yeah.
So I guess I just wanted to bring that up. That's because it sounds easy, right? Of course, we do empathic confrontation. But the nitty gritty part is how do you get in there with them? How do you sell this to them in a way that isn't empathic, where we can reach them? And a part of that, I mean, do you lose clients sometimes?
I think the good thing about many people that have this mode, I think sometimes when it's some of them kind of more maybe complaining protector, you can lose the client more easily because they're more avoidant anyway. Whereas often with kind of, for example, a helpless surrenderer, you're more likely to have a dependent schema underneath. That's going to be helpful because that's going to keep
in your favor.
Keep
engaged.
And in a sense, so you've got that, and I think it's really important to have that rapport. You've already got that, you know, really strong relationship where they feel you're on their side. They feel you get them, that you really want to understand, that you really want to get this, that you know them. And I think there's that sense of, and the, I guess it's also the importance about talking about parts, isn't it? Talking about there's this side, and I really want to understand this side, because when I know what things were like for you as a little child and you were just left alone all the time, that it was just, you know, you had to find a way as a three-year-old to get your mum to be there some of the time to see you. And, you know, I guess as children, you know, all children find ways of doing that, find ways of coping and getting their parents
surviving,
to try and meet their needs. So it's trying to, I guess, put it in the context of those developmental needs and, you know, recognizing that this is probably for, you know, for some clients, a three-year-old coping mode, a two-year-old coping mode, you know, it's a very little mode. And of course that mode is going to be doing that, because that part is stuck in the past as a two-year-old or a three-year-old when this was happening to you. Yes, there's this other part of you that, you know, that doesn't really get that side and doesn't really agree that that is a side. But actually, you know, we all have coping parts, and when they're very young coping parts, they cope in the same way that they did in the past. And
just to be devil's advocate, that you know, so you're saying you're saying I'm making this up. So you're saying I'm making it up. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, and I guess it
was exactly.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. So from there, you know, it's like you know that I really want to understand you, that I really want to get you, that, you know, we're here because we really want to get to that little part of you. And I know that you would, you know, that these are all genuine parts of you that came into your life for a reason to help you. And I think actually this is a kind of a super mode. This is a kind of a mode that knows that all children have needs, that you had needs, and that was just trying to find a way to get your needs met in the past. But actually it's trying to find a way of communicating and trying to, you know, to show me how you're feeling on the inside, because that was all that was the only option that was open to you as a little child. And so I think it's trying to tell me something important, and I really want to know what it is that side of you is trying to tell me, what it's trying to tell me about this little part of you that's underneath, that's crying out for help.
So, and there is a difference between the story about little Jenny and actually connecting to little Jenny, having her in the room here.
Yeah, yeah. Sometimes I'll use babushka dolls, and I'll kind of have, you know, the big mode at the front might be an overcontroller or kind of a detached protector or something. And then we've got progressively down to the little ones. And then the second to last one, that's your pseudo vulnerable mode. It's almost there. We're almost there. And then little one is
so there are people listening to this podcast that are going, what have I got? I've got a new angle on this. And you were saying before, 10 years ago, and I do remember this person you were talking about, you know, there was no podcast, there was no adult.
There's no paper.
There's no internet. No, maybe there was internet 10 years ago, but there was no paper on this. And no. So what would you advise yourself, do you think, from, you know, sort of back then about the treatment of clients like this?
I think I would say trust your gut, you know, that actually listen to what the countertransference is, listen to what your own body is telling you, because, you know, then you recognize whether it's a coping mode or not. And I think it's all in the language, isn't it? Is that actually, just as you say, just by naming it, this is a mode that we probably all knew was there. These are modes that we all knew were there, but I think it's how we recognize them sometimes. And so I guess it's trusting our gut, that this is a coping mode for starters, that actually I'm not feeling that authentic connection here. What's going on? Something's blocking that. What's this client learned in childhood that is blocking our connection now?
Something's going on here.
Exactly.
Yep.
Trusting
yourself. And setting limits and boundaries, because I think that was another issue with me, because of my own, I guess, rescuer mode, my own self-sacrifice schema. You know, there's nothing. I really struggle with seeing someone else suffering and not being able to find a way to help them with that. And in a sense, I was probably making it worse just by keeping on plugging away with the reparenting rather than kind of setting boundaries and limits. You know, and I think with these clients as well, quite often, if it is a helpless surrenderer, often there is an abandonment schema involved. You know, actually setting a limit sometimes on the therapy in terms of the number of sessions and so forth, those sorts of things can also be really important. And really, I think focusing strongly on helping the client develop their own healthy adult mode, making that a focus much earlier on. I think when I work with people with a strong overt helpless surrender, or, you know, or a covert helpless surrender, bringing their healthy adult in earlier into the imagery rescripting, and really working on helping them to receive and take in the care, rather than, I guess, having this kind of bounce off effect where
repel. Yeah, it's like they've been sprayed with some sort of kind of, you know, what they call that stuff that you put on couches that repels, you know.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. Like Teflon. Teflon kind of.
Yeah,
Teflon. I've often likened it to this sort of sense of relief, like, so that, you know, to come and to have a session of like pseudo vulnerability and they experience some subjective relief. But then, of course, it just builds up again. Like, I mean, the next day it sort of builds up. And, of course, I need to see Susan again next week.
Yeah. Yeah, it's tiring being the drug, being the addiction, you know, and not feeling like you're a real person, that you are just actually a kind of
course, then you can think you're bad at the job and I'm not helping and
all that stuff. Yeah. Yeah. But I think actually really focusing in our work on, you know, recording the sessions, for example, getting those clients to actually, I really want you to focus on taking that message in, take it in to your skin, to your, you know, to your body, to your bones, really feel those words in your body.
And I'm taking that.
What it's like to take it in, to receive it and let it sit in you, rather than, you know, I've got my fix and now I'm out of here kind of thing. So that is a really important thing, you know, just to slow things down. What's it like to be in this room with me? What's it like to hear me say that? What's it like to know that I'm here with your little self and that you don't have to prove that to me? You don't have to show that to me, that I'm here already.
Yeah. How have you found with these kind of guys having a bit more of an attunement focus? Have you been using some of that stuff?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I think the attunement is absolutely key with these, you know, with people with these modes, because often they themselves, because there's been such a lack of attunement in childhood, there's a real often difficulty deciphering what their internal world is. You know, what is that emotion? What am I feeling? They've had nobody quite often that's been able to say, oh, you're feeling sad, come here, I'll give you a hug. Or, you know, you're really angry, tell me what's going on for you. They don't often, you know, for many of our clients, they don't know, they can't interpret that interoceptive.
Yeah. Well, they're not tuned in. They're just telling the narrative, you know, of what.
Yeah, they're not tuned in. Yeah.
And so it's actually quite common.
Even when they do, and because there's been a lack of containment and a lack of, I guess, the attunement, then they don't know what it is. They don't know how to put it into words. So it's actually often helping them to find the words for that experience. And that's part of what attunement is, isn't it? It's really helping them to make sense of their inner experience and feel seen and feel understood. And I think, you know, this is a particularly difficult because with pseudo-vulnerable modes, there's that competing need to be seen and that fear of being seen, that need to be understood and that fear of being getting too close. And because there's been a lot of shame and feelings of humiliation around expressing vulnerability and expressing their needs.
It's very complex, isn't it?
Yeah. Mm. Well, Susan, you know, I kind of think of you as our schema sister. You're obviously an expert in eating disorders and over in Scotland. What's happening? Is there any new developments in terms of your work with that? Or
What's happening in the world of eating disorders, Susan?
Well, at the moment, I guess there's a lot of work happening on embodied self. So, you know, in eating disorders, often, you know, it's all about the kind of intellectual modes are very dominant. The overcontroller in particular, of course, detached protector, overanalyzer. And often, you know, it links to this very issue that we're talking about. I think the pseudo-vulnerable modes are very common in eating disorders, often because the person's been silenced, hasn't been able to, you know, there hasn't been an opportunity to express needs, feelings. There's a lot of research around the eating disorder population having very low awareness of their interoceptive experience and feeling very overwhelmed by their interoceptive experience and kind of using the coping modes to shut down their interoceptive experience, using dissociation, kind of alexithymia, all of that being a way of, but this lack of embodied self and this kind of pretend self, which is the coping modes really, is this kind of almost pretend self that they used to operate in the world. And
So it's sort of almost, they're so fused with that that self, but you're going to develop another sense of who you are and how you end up being.
Okay, so you're focused on this topic a lot within the eating disorders as well.
Absolutely.
Managing suit of vulnerability.
Developing an authentic self, I think, is really, is what schema therapy is about, is that it's getting in touch with our authentic self. And in eating disorders, I think this is even, even more important, really, because so often people have become so disconnected from their embodied self that there is no sense of who I am, and such a lack of attunement in those early years for many of our clients with anorexia in particular, that, there's a huge need within schema therapy. And I think that's a real strength of schema therapy, isn't it? That attunement that we do, but we have to get past the coping modes to the really authentic, vulnerable part. And that's a real challenge.
It's that combination, isn't it, then, of empathic confrontation regarding the coping modes, but then also moving them towards this more attuned alternative. So I'm not saying I don't want to listen.
Yeah.
Actually, I'm saying the opposite. I want to deeply listen. I really want to get it on this felt level, not only to go over the narrative again of the next thing that happened, but to really go there with you on this other channel, because the coping modes, including the pseudo-vulnerable modes, are characteristic. They're very cognitive. They're sort of activating things up here, right?
Right.
In a cognitive way. And we're just trying to get them to drop down into that attuned level.
Yeah. To be in the body. And that's the biggest challenge with eating disorders, because often they're very phobic of their interoceptive experience because of the lack of containment. It feels out of control in the body. It feels a scary place to be. And so we have to be there with them.
So this has led you towards a path towards embodied practices?
Yeah, absolutely.
We're considering how to integrate that. That's super interesting. This will be another pod, by the way. So you might write another paper next year on embodied practices, maybe.
Oh, it's a fascinating area. And certainly, there's a lot of embodied practices we're incorporating. And I have been incorporating DBR. I don't know if you're aware of deep brain reorienting. It's very body-based. It's like processing schemas at a body-based level. It's really fascinating.
Wow, fantastic.
Well, it makes sense, because the original model talks about schemas and talks about bodily sensations. Right.
Yeah.
And of course, there's memories in which we deal with that with imagery scripting and all the different parts. But when it comes to the bodily sensations, in terms of interventions, it goes a bit quiet. We don't have body-based interventions as one of the core interventions.
Absolutely. Yeah. There's a huge area of development to be, I guess, expanded on there in the future. So, what space? Yeah.
Well, Susan,
there you go.
That's pretty much the end of the pod. I do think, as we end now, we should mention that you happen to run a very, very good schema therapy course on eating disorders. Of course, you do them live, but you also do them on our platform, schematherapytrainingonline.com. So we always have those coming up, usually every 2 or 3 months. You do your next batch for the eating disorders course. So for those that were interested in some of this stuff, should navigate there and check out your course.
And you're running courses in Scotland and throughout the UK, or?
Yes, so still running them. I mean, most of it now is online, of course.
It's online. Nothing in live. Oh, okay.
running a live one later in Maastricht later this year, and Brazil later this year.
You're liking this online thing a bit too much, Susan.
Oh, it's everything's online in the UK.
Yeah. Well, look, Susan, thank you for sharing the book, the Cambridge Guide to Schema Therapy, together. And, we all love spending time with you. So we love seeing you. And you're talking about something that's actually really, really fantastically interesting. So thanks again, Susan.
Thank you so much.
We'll see you around.
See you soon, guys.
Take care.
Bye. Yeah.